From West Virginia to South Dakota, Michigan to Mississippi, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, progressives are counting on a massive anti-Trump turnout to win the 2020 presidential election. But is that mathematically possible? Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies takes a closer look. Talk of a Social Security payroll tax cut swirled through Washington, D.C. this past week. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on prospects for such a cut. A key law protecting internet platforms is under assault. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Andrea O'Sullivan of the Mercatus Center about why liability protections were critical to development of the internet. And pure evil does exist in the world today. We saw it again in El Paso and Dayton. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Turnout can and often does affect the outcome of elections. After all, the only voters who matter are those who actually go to the polls. But as we approach 2020, some Democrats are counting on a historic turnout of left-leaning voters to win the presidency. Can that happen? To find out, we turn to Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Keith, every election we hear candidates and the political professionals on both sides of the aisle saying it's all going to come down to turnout, 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 turnout. How important is turnout to candidates, particularly at the presidential level?
Well, turnout matters a lot. You can't win unless you get your folks and your supporters to the polls. The thing is, most people who do vote, vote fairly habitually. And turnout really ends up mattering in a fairly small number of states on the presidential side. In the last election, there were several states. There were actually five states who had a difference of less than 1.5%. And in those states, a little bit of turnout makes a huge difference. It matters a little bit more when you go down ballot, when the races are much closer for Congress and Senate and governor, but even a president, if it's turning on just a few states, turnout makes a huge difference.
There was a lot of talk after the 2016 election, Keith, that Hillary Clinton didn't get the turnout that Barack Obama got, and that impacted the election. Do the numbers bear that out?
Well, she did not get the same turnout that he did, but they should never have expected that. And the reason is we were in a time where the country wasn't, you know, at war or considered, or the war conflicts weren't at the top of the news stories at the time. The economy was growing. And in those types of periods where the economy is good and the country is generally at peace or considers itself at peace, turnout drops. Things are fine. Why should I go out to the polls? So she shouldn't have expected a very high turnout. And in the end, the turnout actually was relatively high, again, given the peaceful conditions. I mean, turnout in 2008 was 61.6%. In 2016, it was 60.1%. So that's not much of a fallout, and it was actually an increase from 2012, where it was just over 58.5%. I think her complaints about turnout is a little sour grape. She should have expected the kind of drop-off she experienced.
You have written an article for The Hill on the subject of turnout, and take us back, Keith, if you will, in terms of presidential elections throughout history. What has been the norm or the average of turnout of voters for presidential races, which you would at least theoretically think would be the level of race that would get the highest number of voters out to the polls?
Well, it depends on your time frame. Turnout averaged in about the low 60s from the end of the Second World War up till 1968. Then the franchise was expanded to voting age was dropped from age of 21 to age of 18. Turnout fell a little bit as people who are younger and who make less income tend to turn out at much lower rates. And it was about in the mid 50s up and through 2004. Now, lately, it's ticked up a little bit. It's averaged just about 60% from 2004 to 2016, but it's still fairly consistent. Turnout doesn't move more than 2 or 3 points. It's when the country's experienced some type of foreign policy crisis or when people are feeling economically insecure, especially when unemployment is rising. That's really what ticks up turnout, but it still doesn't tick it up really that much. We haven't had turnout above 64% since before World War I.
As we look at the upcoming presidential election, Keith, we have Democrats putting out a whole wide array of ultra-left-wing public policies, and their theory is that this is going to motivate the great progressive base, and that's going to result in a huge turnout increase among the left wing, and that will carry them to victory. Is that even remotely possible or realistic?
That is a triumph of wishful thinking over evidence. There's no evidence to show that that's the case. A sort of far left candidate or left candidate running on these unpopular issues can really only win if the economy goes into a serious tailspin or we have a significant foreign policy crisis. And those are two things over which neither party has a great deal of control. If you look at the 2016 election, this is really the remarkable thing, is when you combine the, for lack of a better term, center-right protest vote, which is Gary Johnson from the Libertarian Party and Evan McMullen, the Independent, they got over 5.2 million votes. But Jill Stein, the sort of left protest vote from the Green Party, she didn't even clear 1.5 million. So if you look at the, if you try to do a little bit of a math of your projecting forward, if Donald Trump can just get half of that center-right protest vote, that's more votes than half of Jill Stein's vote, plus record Hispanic turnout, plus near-record African-American turnout. Even with that, you don't ever overcome that latent vote. And the interesting thing, too, or the thing that Democrats on the left are forgetting about, these libertarian and right-wing independent votes, these are people who actually come out. It takes a lot of effort to get someone who's never voted or rarely votes to come out. By definition, they are not engaged. So that's a big hurdle to come over. I don't see how the math works out in their turnout strategy.
Let's take a quick look then, Keith, at the key states, the states where this election is going to be fought out: Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, perhaps maybe Virginia, New Hampshire. In those states, what sort of increased turnout would the Democratic nominee need to be able to pull out in order to achieve victory in those key electoral vote states?
Well, in Michigan, a Democratic candidate doesn't need a great deal. Hillary Clinton only lost Michigan by a little under 11,000 votes, so that's a little bit tighter. It all, again, depends on where the third-party sort of center-right protest vote goes. If Donald Trump's able to attract most of that vote, states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Florida are out of reach. And Gary Johnson received almost 150,000 votes in Pennsylvania. If Donald Trump gets that, then the Democrats are going to have to overcome a 110,000 vote margin. So that's fairly significant. I mean, you're going to need, for a Democratic turnout strategy to win, you would need record turnout in the state of Pennsylvania, and you need to collect all those votes that are coming from the new voters in order to win. And you'd need turnout in Wisconsin that would be about second all time to do the same thing. I mean, that is a big bar to clear without some type of crisis in the country.
We have been talking with Keith Naughton, who is principal of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith is joining us from time to time as we take a look at polling and other factors that are going to impact upon the 2020 presidential election. Keith, where can folks go if they want to read more?
Well, they can read my columns on The Hill. I'm in there regularly as a contributing author, and my Twitter handle is at knaughton711.
Keith Naughton of Silent Majority Strategies. Keith, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth is not only keeping an eye on all the political developments. We talked about those last week. We're going to go back to policy this week. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back.
And Scott, there's an ongoing situation with Social Security and the Social Security Trust Fund. Will money be there for future generations? Lots of reforms have been bantied about for the last several decades. The Trump administration, however, is working on some proposals, not quite at the top of anybody's agenda yet, but can you give us a little bit of background as to what the administration is thinking?
I think your listeners might remember that during President Obama's administration, there was a temporary holiday, meaning a temporary tax cut for everybody's Social Security payroll taxes. And that endeavor was financed through a general revenues transfer, so basically added onto the deficit. There are numerous ways you could go about structuring Social Security payroll tax reform proposal. And we certainly think that it could be a way to decrease the tax burden on middle-income and lower-income workers. Nonetheless, while this is happening, we still have a looming crisis with Social Security and the solvency surrounding that program. Certainly, there's folks like myself that don't fully intend for Social Security to be around when we retire, but it should be a supplemental income to our retirement security portfolio. So what exactly does the program look like going forward? I think that's up for debate. But right now, President Trump is looking to inject a little bit more growth into the economy by reducing payroll taxes for lower and middle income taxpayers. Right now, the threshold for Social Security payroll taxes is $132,900, which means on all those dollars that you earn, you are taxed 6.2%, and your employer is also taxed 6.2%. What is that total to? 12.4%. What does that mean? If you're self-employed, 12.4% of your money that you earn up to $132,900 is going to Treasury right now to pay for Social Security, when in fact it might not be around for us.
If there were a cut or a temporary suspension of some sort in the payroll tax, would that immediately inject a jolt into the economy? I know the left has been beating the drum. They're trying to talk us into a recession for political purposes, but the president seems to be responding by trying to find some ways to juice the economy, which, of course, you're always trying to do. Would such a payroll tax cut or holiday have that impact?
It depends exactly how it's structured, how long it is. Is this a payroll holiday for 6 months or a year and a half? How does the economy react when the tax goes back up from, let's say that they cut it in half to 6.2% or 3.1% for the employee and the employer? The devil's in the details here, Lohman, so we got to wait and see exactly what the administration proposes. But meanwhile, I think that it's important to remember that in order for us to really increase individual freedom and economic prosperity, we need to have personal responsibility surrounding our retirement security. And if you tracked the growth of Social Security benefits compared to the growth of the stock market, it's a dramatically better investment for people to jump into their own personal savings accounts and grow their own retirement security. There's a lot of funds that are very safe investments. This isn't a gigantic risk. Now, the problem is that when a lot of voters hear that Republicans or conservatives or Donald Trump or anybody wants to do something to save Social Security for future generations, what they're interpreting that as is a benefit cut. And nobody's talking about cutting benefits for those that are in the current Social Security program or nearing retirement. I think the real issue here is, what does Social Security look like in the future, and is it currently on a sustainable course? The answer to the latter is that it's definitely going to be insolvent. Then the next 20 years, possibly they'll try to put on a Band-Aid in 2034 and make this solvent for a couple more years. But in reality, there is going to be an automatic cut by as much as 20% to benefits, unless we actually do something about it.
in terms of then this potential payroll tax cut or holiday that may occur, and it is in a very early discussion stage, so nobody should rush out and spend their newfound money. In terms of that, would not that then deprive the Social Security system of revenue? And you're talking about being insolvent in 20 years. Wouldn't that just advance that and send us into insolvency sooner because you wouldn't be putting as much money into the fund?
It would if you didn't find a way to offset it. So I think that Nancy Pelosi would say, well, let's pay for it by increasing taxes on millionaires and billionaires. Well, obviously, they look for every opportunity to inject socialism into our economy and wealth discrimination. So I would not be surprised if that was what they went to the administration with a sort of a first offer on how to do a payroll tax holiday. On the other hand, you know what we could actually do, Loman? We could cut spending. And with the savings on the spending, you could use a general revenues transfer. That's sort of what President Obama wanted to do with the general revenues transfer. It's just he added to the deficit when he did it. So nonetheless, a payroll tax holiday can certainly inject some economic activity to those that it would benefit. Just imagine having 6% more on $100,000. There's $6,000 more. Now, if that's over the course of a year or over the course of 6 months, that's the difference between $3,000 and $6,000. And what does that activity do for somebody? Does it help them pay a bill? Does it help them go buy something that they might not buy otherwise, a new bed, a new microwave, a fixer-upper project on a bathroom? There's a lot of things that folks can do with their own money, and we certainly support the American people having control and as much control as possible over their own money.
Well, of course, we will continue to keep an eye on this as the proposed payroll cut unfolds. Perhaps it will, perhaps it will not. And, of course, all the reform measures you've talked about. So we will, from time to time, keep our listeners filled in on what's happening there. In the meantime, Scott, tell us a bit about the Club for Growth.
Sure. So the Club for Growth is a membership organization of over 250,000 Americans. Our organization is united because we believe strongly in economic liberty and economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is www.clubforgrowth.org. And they can also follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
An obscure but hugely important law has protected the Internet from many forms of content liability. Here to talk about the importance of that law are Reason Magazine's Eric Boehm and Andrea O'Sullivan from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Eric?
Some conservatives, like Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, are waging a war on something called Section 230. It's a part of a 1996 telecommunications law that really provided the legal framework for the free and open Internet that we enjoy today. Now, some conservatives, like Senator Hawley, say that it's because of Section 230 that websites are allowed to engage in anti-conservative bias. And regardless of whether that's an accurate description of what certain websites and content providers are doing, it's a pretty dangerous thing to start messing around with the law that essentially guarantees the right to free speech online. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Andrea O'Sullivan. She is a tech writer and a columnist for Reason.com. You can check out her latest piece at Reason.com this week, looking at why some law enforcement want a red flag tool for social media like Twitter and why that's a terrible idea. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But first of all, Andrea, thanks so much for taking some time and joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
As I said, Andrea, I think of Section 230 as being the thing that guarantees a free and open Internet. It is, in my mind, it is as important as the First Amendment for sort of the legal underpinnings of free speech that the modern world is built upon, at least the modern online world. Before we talk about what the world would look like if we didn't have Section 230, tell our listeners a little bit about what the law is and what it does.
Sure. And I think you're absolutely right. It is kind of a foundational piece of modern communications law. And some scholars go so far as to say it actually affords better protections than the First Amendment when it comes to speech online. Let's back up and talk about what Section 230 is. It is a small but mighty portion of the Communications Decency Act, which was passed, I believe, in 1996. And it is short, but it does a lot. called, some people call it the 26 words that built the internet. What it essentially does is it clarifies that if you are a web platform, right, that you host third-party content, whether that be just simple speech in a comment section or videos or really anything that could have been imagined in 1996, you're not going to be liable for the content of that third-party produced content. So specifically, somebody couldn't say, hey, this content defames me or, you know, it's hurting my business, you owe me money. It was trying to kind of carve out a space for these new web services to be able to take flight.
I think there are a lot of bad arguments made for revisiting or revising or changing Section 230, but if I could play devil's advocate for a second, Andrea, I think the best argument that's made is that, look, this is something that was written in 1996. That doesn't sound like it was all that long ago, but in terms of how the internet ages, that was decades ago. It was a lifetime ago. The lawmakers who wrote that law maybe couldn't have expected the internet to develop the way it did. They certainly couldn't have foreseen the explosion of social media and the sort of ability to mass communicate that social media allows for. So the internet is very different now. Maybe it is time to revisit exactly how we look at the sort of legal structures that protect platforms online.
The internet is totally different, right? Who could have imagined what would have developed? But I think it's pretty easy. It's fair to argue that it would not have developed how it did if not for Section 230. I actually sympathize with a lot of Section 230's critics, and in fact, most people can because there are critics on the left and the right. Right on the left, the criticism is platforms aren't doing enough to moderate, right? We have things like hate speech. We have things like, you know, even like terrorist content, right? Platforms should be held liable for that. From the right, you have kind of the inverse argument where, like it or not, these are venues for speech. And if one side or one political point or even a competitor, right, is being censored, then that's a damage to the public forum. I don't think Section 230 per se is the way to get around that. Removing Section 230 is the way to get around that. What it does is it enters another political lever into the process, right, which is just going to be pulled depending on what party is in power. It's kind of a new version of the fairness doctrine for the internet.
We are talking with Andrea O'Sullivan. She is a tech writer and a columnist for Reason.com. Andrea, I want to switch gears here. We only have about a minute left here, so I'm going to rush you through this last bit. But you've got a piece up at Reason this week looking at how some law enforcement and the FBI, they want this new red flag tool for social media. They want to be able to identify potentially dangerous speech that could lead to acts of violence on social media and as a way to prevent mass shootings or other atrocities. You say this is a bad idea, something the government shouldn't be allowed to have. Why is that?
Well, first of all, the algorithms they'd be using can't parse intent very well, right? So people use slang online, they joke around, they're being ironic. It'd be very easy for the FBI. So what they want is to have a tool to kind of comb through all public posts and say, oh, this guy is going to, you know, he's a threat. We need to, like, watch him, right? That'll lead to a lot of false positives. That'll lead to a lot of resources wasted. And frankly, it kind of just sounds like a boondoggle, but it seems very futuristic. So the Bureau wants to look like they're cutting edge.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to be concerned about for sure. Anytime you have sort of government databases, these big dragnets, you certainly get a lot of people caught up in them who are completely innocent. And that's definitely a worry that has to be addressed there. There's really so much to talk about. But unfortunately, we are out of time for today, Andrea. We really appreciate you joining us on the show.
Yeah, great. Thanks for talking to me.
And again, that is Andrea O'Sullivan. She is a tech writer and a columnist for Reason.com. You can check out her latest piece at Reason.com about social media red flag tools and why giving them to the government would be a terrible idea. She has a new piece at Reason every week, usually on Tuesday mornings. Again, check that out at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me again next week right back here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Does pure evil exist in the world? It still does, as Dr. Paul Kangor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The tragic mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton prompted the nation's pundits and politicians to once again play the blame game. We had various sources blaming Donald Trump, as well as predictable arguments about insufficient gun laws, about the shooter's political ideological beliefs and motivations, about the shooter's being mentally ill, or about a culture lacking values, morals, proper family life. Personally, I find myself again and again in these episodes retreating to another diagnosis, one that might not apply perfectly in every situation, granted, but I think needs to be acknowledged. This is evil. Plain, pure, unmistakable evil. Evil exists, and this is it, personified. Of course, many of us say that in these situations of mass shootings. In this case, however, with Dayton and El Paso, there may be more to it. That reality seemed unmistakably clear in the blank face and empty eyes of the El Paso shooter, who looked like he was possessed by something. It's even clearer in the statements of the Dayton shooter, Connor Betts, and those who knew him. "He was in a dark place," a young woman who knew Betts told Fox News. "He heard voices in his head." She wasn't the only one saying that. The young man's former girlfriend attested to him hearing voices, being tormented by what she called dark evil things, and having hallucinations of some sort. Other friends described Connor Betts as, quote, "kind of dark," unquote. Dark indeed. Can we dare venture a spiritual explanation for these shooters? Consider, what's chilling about Betts, the Dayton shooter, was that he literally tweeted, "Hail Satan," and "Hail Satan Eternal." He even ended some tweets with a hashtag, hashtag Hail Satan, and stated in his Twitter bio that he was, quote, "going to hell and not coming back," unquote. That's spiritual. I don't want to overdo things here. The degree to which this young man might have been devoted to the devil, possibly bordering even the demonic, that's something I certainly don't know. I suppose we would need testimony of exorcists as well as psychologists. I do mention it, however, because it's a fresh reminder that no matter how many excuses we try to come up with after these horrible tragedies so revoltingly common, we should never shrug off the reality that these episodes prove, first and foremost, that evil exists. Malcolm Muggeridge said that, quote, "The depravity of man is at once the most empirically verifiable reality, but at the same time, the most intellectually resisted fact." Well, it was resisted again in these latest shootings, especially by those hoping to conjure up other demons to blame. Insufficient gun laws, the NRA, Donald Trump. Still worse, when the supernatural is brought into this conversation, it's not always favorable to God. The modern world is more prone to ask, "Where was God?" rather than "Where was the devil?" Quote, "The only time some men ever think of God," stated Bishop Fulton Sheen, "is when they want to find someone to blame for their own sins. Without ever saying so, they assume that man is responsible for everything good and beautiful in the world, but God is responsible for its wickedness and its wars. They ignore the fact that God is like a playwright who wrote a beautiful drama, gave it to men to act with all the directions for acting, and then made a botch of it." Unquote. So true. It has been said that the devil's greatest trick has been to persuade us that he doesn't exist. Well, it looks like Connor Betts, the Dayton shooter, emphatically disagreed. Betts made his dark case, and now he's not coming back. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, A Pope and a President.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KRNG-FM in Wadsworth, Nevada. Welcome to our new listeners in the Silver State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. You can also join in the conversation by checking out our page on Facebook or find us on Twitter at American Radio Journal. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.